session number 18577, Reel 4.
Barclay Meredith, Reel 4.
Yes, it was nightfall, and the wood we'd been fighting in was Levacy wood, and it was as far, I think, as any unit got on D-Day. And for this, our tank commander, Lionel Knight, was awarded the MC. Suddenly afterwards, that during all the commemorations of D-Day, eventually, no mention was ever made of this in any of the programs or reports that I read. Tanks don't stay out in woods or the open at night. They lager, and we withdrew then to an area where the whole squadron lagered together. I think it was a very short night. The first thing you have to do is to refuel your tank with petrol or diesel, and stock up again with ammunition. Look after your tank first, just like the cavalry used to look after their horses when they returned. And then look after your own sustenance, rations up and a hot drink, etc. I think we spent that first few hours of night just on our blankets on the ground next to the tank. We learned not to sleep under a tank, because if you're on soft ground, the whole thing could sink on top of you, so that was a bit dicey. It was a noisy night, whether we slept or not. I think we must have dozed anyway. But we were up before first light to take up new positions. On that first day, we'd reached Levacy Wood, and it took another month of hard, bloody fighting to get back to that same point. I can't remember details of places or particular battles. There were no major battles so far as we were concerned. They were all a continuous action, a lot of shelling from both sides. It was a sort of hiatus, I suppose. Neither side was moving far in any direction. We were told that we were holding the German armour on our flank of the beachhead in order to take pressure off the Americans, who it was hoped would break through from the Cherbourg area, which eventually, of course, they did. We had a couple of mishaps with our tank. No direct hits or anything like that. We shed a couple of tracks hitting mines. And it's an ill wind that blows nobody any good, because I think we had about the nicest piece of roast pork I've ever had that I can remember on one of those occasions. We shed a track, so we were behind everybody else. Behind everybody else and out of sight. It was farmland, of course, Normandy, all farmland. And there were a few loose wild pigs running about. It looked a tasty dish, so we tried to catch one of these pigs. Not very successfully to start with, but there were some pioneers who'd landed after D-Day, and they were laying down roads, and it was a huge chicken wire mesh with steel rods across. And one of these chaps was holding up one of these steel rods, and as the pig ran by, he dropped the rod and pole-axed it on the back of the neck. Our tank driver was a bit of a tough boy and was detailed to cut its throat and bleed it. I don't know how it was carved up, but we shared it between these engineers, pioneers. Go some to another crew, I think. I roasted this leg of pork in a cut open 4-gallon petrol tin. I made an oven of the tin, and it was absolutely super. So perhaps it was a bit of a boon that we lost our track that day. I think our next big battle was just after a 2,000 bomber raid on Khan. There have been several unsuccessful attempts to break through to Khan, and one of these was preceded by a tremendous bomber raid. I've never seen so many planes in my life. They were going over continuously in a continuous stream out and back. There was a tremendous noise, and both from the planes and from the bombardment. The next big operation there was Operation Goodwood. And this was another planned breakout south of Khan. And there was a plane in front of Khan, and it was very open. And the 13th, 18th Hussars, which were also part of the 27th Armoured Brigade, were supposed to lead this attack. And once they got to their objective, which was south of this plain, Staff Yeomen were to go through the 13th, 18th, and it was to be spearheaded by C Squadron and by number one troop, which was our troop. And we went through the 13th, 18th, and made our way across this plain. There were a tremendous number of tanks in this battle, and there were many, many knocked out. And we'd reached a railway embankment when we were disabled. We had an armour-piercing shell shot through the side of the tank, which entered the engine. And we were very, very lucky, because normally when a tank is hit, it brews up, it catches fire. But this shot had gone through the side of the tank. It had missed the turret rotunda, which is stacked with, in that case it was 75mm shells, all highly explosive. But we were lucky, it was a diesel engine. And when the shot went through, it set off a fire extinguisher as well, so we didn't brew up. We saw what we thought was smoke coming from the engine, but it was in fact the fire extinguisher. But we bailed out anyway.
Do you know where the shell came from?
The shot came from our left-hand side. I read in the regimental history recently that it was thought it could have been a stray shot from somebody on our flank. But I don't think that can be so, because remember we had spearheaded this particular advance. We'd gone through the 13th and 18th Hussars. We were in the lead, so there was nobody up level with us. And I haven't got any doubt that it was a self-propelled gun or a hull-down which was hull down, and you can't see the gun then. And at the time, our corporal's tank, which was to our left, we thought had seen the flash of this gun and had shot back at it and destroyed it, because we had no further fire from that direction. But that was us out of the action from that point in time.
Were there tanks going up all round you?
I didn't see many. If you remember earlier in the chat, I mentioned that you see very little from inside the tank. I didn't see a great deal of it myself. But there were a lot of tanks going forward in that battle, and I know for a fact that many were destroyed. Because we were disabled, our tank commander took over another tank from the troop, and we were safer off inside the tank, as it hadn't brewed up at that point in time, so we got back in. There were a couple of Germans just beyond the railway embankment who popped up occasionally and tried to lob grenades into the turret. This was infuriating because we couldn't depress our gun low enough to fire back. So I ordered the gunner to use his stun gun. Stun guns are a notorious weapon, probably the worst weapon that was ever designed. It jammed, so we couldn't fire back with that. In the end, we fired a Verdi pistol, a Marine pistol at them, but they disappeared anyway. So that was us out of Goodwood. Goodwood didn't achieve its object. And my next recollection is that at the end of July, we were withdrawn and we came back to England. We were going back to pick up some duplex drive tanks, DD tanks, which were the amphibious tanks that were used in parts of the landing in Normandy. They were incredible things once we got to see them and know them. We went back to the beachhead and were astounded when we saw this huge floating Mulberry Harbour, which had been built within a few weeks after the landing. We had withdrawn back to the beachhead area prior to this on one occasion. I think it was about 4 weeks after we'd landed. We went back for a rest, and the army had often criticised for not being a well organised service, but I don't think anything could be farther from the truth. We got back to the beachhead area, and there were bath areas, shower areas, all set up, and we had to ditch all our clothes, which were taken away, a jolly good bath, shower, what have you, and a jolly good clean up, and a completely fresh set of kit. It was quite a nice break. I think we even put on a concert one night. We were probably out for about 3 days. It was a good concert because I think somebody found a bottle of brandy in one of the chateau or farm outbuildings. So we got something to liven our spirits up with. Our rations used to be very good. I think a lot of them were American rations. We have what they called a 15-man one-day pack, which were normally issued to platoons of infantry. So one pack lasted a tank crew 3 days, but since we normally had only four in the crew instead of five, we got extra rations. Pretty good stuff, actually. But there we were, back on our way to England and back to New Haven from whence we'd set out about a month before. No, as you were, 8 weeks before. We went to a place near Yarmouth where we were to be trained in how to use these DD tanks. We very much doubted whether the wretched things would stay afloat, because it was a normal 35-ton Sherman tank, and which had an apron, a canvas apron, erected around it by massive rubber pillars, which were inflated by air. And once the canvas side had been raised, steel struts like a pram hood strut were sort of braced to keep it up. And once this tank had been launched into a lake or a river, it looked just like a small boat, because there would only be about a metre of freeboard showing, yet there was a 35-ton tank hanging below the surface of the water. When we landed in Normandy, each troop had one firefly, a 17-pounder gun. The tank was called a firefly, whereas the other three tanks in the troop would have been, the other two tanks in the troop would have been a 75mm. But the DD tanks obviously had the 75mm, so we didn't have the benefit of our much larger gun. Training was a bit hairy for a lot of people because it was a bit claustrophobic. You were trained in the use of submarine Davis escape apparatus, and to do this you were submerged into you'd got the hull of a tank in a deep pit which was then submerged in water, and a tank turret, well, under the driver's compartment is a very confined space. And to be, particularly if you couldn't swim, to be submerged in this tank in underwater was quite claustrophobic for a lot of people. How many people ever got out of these things when they were landing in Normandy, bearing in mind they were launched quite a bit offshore in rough seas? I don't know. I've no idea how many people did manage to escape if they were submerged. Anyway, it wouldn't have given me very much confidence. We trained on a lake near Scunthorpe, and then we went up, near Yarmouth, and then went up to a place near Scunthorpe where we practiced launching and sailing on the river, because you had to learn a certain number of navigation skills. The tanks were driven by propellers which were attached to the rear drive sprockets, and they were steered by the tank commander standing on top of the turret, holding a lever which he pushed from side to side to alter the rake of the propellers. So it was a fairly crude sort of steering device. Nevertheless, I suppose it was effective. As I say, it was an ill wind that blows nowhere any good, because having gone back to pick up these tanks and to train in them, we also all had a week's leave, which was, well, unexpected, and to say the least, well, super. We went back to Normandy at the beginning of September.
With the DD tanks?
With the DD tanks, yes. I think we went back from New Haven again. And of course this time we landed on Mulberry, so it was a much easier landing. And we were told, I think, that we were going to use them to cross the Albert Canal. I can't see how they could have used DD tanks to cross a canal, because the sides would have been sheer, so I can't really think that was one of the objectives. I think it was more likely that that they intended them to be used perhaps for crossing the Seine or other rivers in France. But in the event, the tanks were on transporters, and we got to Brussels on the day that Brussels was liberated. Regrettably, we didn't stay in Brussels. We went to a place called Chateau. The name escapes me. It was a chateau I called Chateau Rubens, because the painter Rubens was alleged to have lived there at one time. But it was outside Brussels, I think, near a place called Vilvoord. And I think the officers were billeted in the chateau, and we had some tents in the grounds of the chateau. And I think we were there for a few weeks. That was another quite pleasant interlude, because we were able to walk to perhaps nearby villages and make friends with people and spend time in the local bar. And we did, in fact, make friends with one family who were very kind and entertained us. From there we moved to the Dutch coast. One of the squadrons took part in trying to clear the islands in the Scheldt, South Beveland and Walcheren, and we weren't involved in that. The Scheldt was a very muddy and not a suitable area for DD tanks. But I think there was some liaison with the Canadians to help clear these islands. We moved further into Holland to a place near Sluiskil. We were billeted in a chemical factory there, and I think we spent the Christmas in that area. We then went on further into Holland, and I think we trained on the River Meuse, which was in flood. So the tank park, which was in a wood to conceal the tanks, was underwater anyway, so you had to wade through knee-deep water to get to your tank anyway, which wasn't very conducive to good training. The rivers were flowing very fast and wasn't very easy to negotiate. It was difficult to get tanks down into the river and even more difficult to get them out. So training continued on that sort of river, together with some Canadians who came to train with us and who had some experience of DD tanks. We lost our original commanding officer, who was promoted in his stead. We had a couple of changes of command, and eventually we had a chap from the Guards called Colonel Trotter who came to take over the regiment. And
how was the previous CO regarded?
Our first CO, Colonel Eady, was tremendously highly regarded. He was the man who'd taken the regiment right the way through the desert and had come back to England with them and taken them through the Normandy campaign. And it was at the end, it was just before we came back to England to pick up our DD tanks that Colonel Eady was transferred to the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. We understood he was going to be brigadier in charge of the tactical wing, but he was a very much respected man. He was very well thought of by the whole regiment, and we were very sad to see him go. He was a brilliant tactician, and I'm quite convinced that we got as far as we did because of him, and that we lost as few tanks as we did because of him. His 2IC, I think it was a Major Farquhar, was equally respected. But he too was posted elsewhere. Why these changes? I think these changes probably took place when we transferred into the 79th Armoured Division, which was run by General Hobart. I think he tried to model himself on Monty. He used to sort of pinch Monty's berry idea and put his badges around the top. He wasn't very well regarded by the men.
Hobart?
Not in our regiment, anyway. He may well have been in the other regiments, but he didn't go down well with the staffs.
For what reason?
I don't know. He always appeared to be a bit of a pushy fellow and a bit of a showman. I think he was very proud of what he'd done in creating the 79th Armoured Division. And he was probably justified in being proud of this. I don't think the Staff Yeomanry ever felt part of the 79th Armoured Division. There were a lot of... I think that all the sort of tanks which had been adapted to for specific purposes, though I know as Hobart's funnies, and some of them were brilliant inventions and brilliantly used. You got your Churchill tanks which were converted for use with fascines, which would throw huge bundles of palings into a tank ditch to cross it. You got church with a Bailey Bridge on it. You've got the really fearsome flamethrowers, which were horrifying to see in use. How anybody ever survived being winkled out of bunkers or trenches with the use of these things, I don't know, but they were really fearsome looking things. So yes, he got some very useful things, and the flails, which used to clear minefields, were another brilliant invention. Very, very good. Somehow, I don't think we ever really felt part of Hobart's crew as a regiment. That was my feeling as a soldier on the ground.
Did you ever see Hobart?
Only from a distance. But, Mark, you very rarely see your commanding officer as a soldier. I don't think I ever spoke to our commanding officer, not the colonel. You very rarely saw your squadron leader. I don't think I ever knew you all by name. The officer you saw all the time was your troop leader. He was either a lieutenant or a captain. So you didn't come into touch with the commissioned officers very often. I think I probably saw Montgomery more than we saw anybody else, but he was a man who liked to be seen, and he was respected well, particularly by his desert troops. And the Staff's young men were a desert regiment, so they were very proud of Monty. And you did see Monty up the line. His motto, he was determined that he would put everybody in the picture. And this was evidenced by all the information which was given to you preceding D-Day. If other people knew what their job was and what other people were going to do, they would feel far more confident in trying to do it. And I think he was right too. It's disturbing to see some of the histories which are written by people who weren't there at the time and who try to analyse military campaigns and military leaders. I think Montgomery did a good job, and it's a bit sad to see read some of these books which infer that he was an inferior general to people like Patton, who I don't think was a good general. He got the opportunities, and he was able to push through and break through the Falaise Gap because Montgomery had taken the pressure off Patton. And that was my view anyway. Bradley may be a different kettle of fish.
You were just talking about the change of CO.
Yes, yeah. The CEO in the house was a Colonel Trotter, who came from the Guards. I think he was quite a decent man. Our next big operation was obviously to cross the Rhine. I think we took part in various operations going up to the Rhine, but that was the next really big operation, and we were to cross the Rhine with the 51st Highland Division, and we were to cross, I think there was a point near a place called Rees. The current of the Rhine was estimated to be about 4 knots. And that meant that you had to launch your tanks quite a way upriver because of the speed of the current, which would take you down. 4 knots is quite a fast speed for a river, actually, I believe. And if you